And my prayer thought tonight is that all of us may discern some new way of thinking about grace, something that we go by and pass and take for granted every moment, and maybe we'll be arrested, startled, have our eyes opened to grace that's all around us that we didn't notice. Amen. How many were here last night? So I got a little bit to build on, about a third of you. I'm not going to try and repeat that. But I did want to say a little bit here. I think I'll hold that a little until we get a little further down. I'm supposed to hawk books a little here because, for one thing, I was the guy that ordered them. And that means that if they don't sell, they got to send them back. But a more compelling reason is that they're good. And one of them is called Healing the Masculine Soul by Gordon Dalby. Happens to be a friend of mine. There's a lot of talk today about the men's movement. Some of it has little or nothing to do with the Christian faith. This one really does. He grounds it in the Bible and Christianity a lot. Those of us who sense, I think we all do in some way, the discomfort in our society today with racism, and even if you live in a small town away from the city, you can't help but feel it in this country. This is a good book for a church or any group to study. It's not a guilt trip. It's trying to understand the roots of racism in America by Joe Barnett, who lives what he writes. He lives in a very simple way in an apartment in Bronx, in a heavily urbanized area with all the problems of crime and drugs at his doorstep. This is a little thing I've been reading. I see they have a couple more copies. Addiction and Grace. It's very good because it lists that alcohol isn't the only addiction people have. And this I have to modestly peddle. It's a little book of prayers that my daughter and I got together. She did the artwork, and I collected prayers from a lot of different sources, a lot of the hymnals of different churches, and the Bible, and wrote a few. So, that's it. End of the commercial. I think we'll just jump into Amazing Grace. How many have seen any of Bill Moyer's tape here? Some of you saw it here already? Nobody's seen it so far here. How many saw it before? Okay, some of you. Okay, so it'll be a repeat, but it's a kind of tape that bears repeating, and you learn something new each time. I'm just going to play maybe 10, 15 minutes of it. For those of you who weren't here earlier this week when we played the beginning of it, let me just fill in a little of the history of this amazing song, probably the most popular hymn in Christendom. I don't know of any, including our old Lutheran national anthem, A Mighty Fortress, Ein Feste Burg, that's more popular, more widespread, and speaks to the heart more than Amazing Grace. It's really an amazing tune. It pointed out how it's been taken over, and I think this is the work of the Holy Spirit, by the secular forces in our society. You know, it's popular today to put down show business, rock, Hollywood, and all. They're good whipping people. But Judy Collins, in the early 70s, popularized this, and it hit the top of the charts. And it was the most popular song at many concerts. It was one that they all waited for. And they'd have a rock concert that had little or nothing to do, as far as some of us can understand, with Christianity per se. And then along comes Amazing Grace. Go ahead, Amazing Grace, and it was amazing, the feeling, the awe that swept over the crowd. And it shows Judy singing this song in London, 70,000 fans who didn't know what it was at first. And the power of the tune, and then the words just took over. so that when they were done, the 70,000 seat stadium was like a cathedral. And all these rock fans, some of them maybe had a little too much to drink or a little too much pot, all were just awed by that song and the power of it. Amazing. So I had a friend preach a sermon at Christmas called "You Can't Keep God Out." And that's part of grace. You can't keep God out. If God is blocked by some of our stuffy Lutheran ways, God just finds another avenue, and it's like water going and finding its own way and level. It's amazing, of course. The author, anybody know anything about the author? John Newton. John Newton, who was, of all things, a slave trader. About 250 years ago, in the middle of the 17th century. And he plied the African coast, going down with rum and other things that he could peddle in exchange for slaves. And this showed the slave boats, or a replica of them, and how the bill of lading went. Two adults, one woman, one man, and three people under 3'6". Well, you know, they're talking about kids. And how they separated them. And John Newton was doing this, and one time he was in a storm, and he was a cussing, rough, tough sailor. And he was a captain of the ship. And he came into his cabin, and he talked to the first mate, and he said, "Well, I don't know if we're going to get it through. The ship may be sunk in this storm." And he said, "If so, Lord, have mercy on us." And then he went to his own cabin. He thought about that. Why in the world did he ever say that? That was foreign to his lips. He wasn't used to that kind of language, or even the concept behind it. And that started something going. Well, shortly after that, he was converted, but only halfway. That's the trouble sometimes with the talk about conversion. You have to ask, to what and for what, and how extensive is a conversion? We can say a little bit more about that when I see some prisoners who relate to this song. Prisoners in jail. We've got a customer here. Did he leave? Maybe he didn't know there's another chair. The power of this song to reach so many people. Well, then John Newton still continued as a slave trader, even after he was converted, at least part way. But he did the halfway thing. He just treated the slaves a little better, gave them a little more rations, a little more water, packed them in a little less densely in the, here, there's a chair up, oh, you got one. A little more room down in the hold of the ship. And it wasn't until a few years later that he went all the way and realized he could not live off the sweat of other human beings, as Lincoln said in the second inaugural. And he was converted completely away from his former life to this life. "I once was blind, but now I see. Saved a wretch like me," and so forth. Then he became a rector of a little church in England, and that's where he spent the rest of his life. And he and another clergy person had a clergyman had a midweek prayer meeting. And they both composed hymns. And so they decided to write a hymn, each for a new hymn, for each prayer meeting. That's a big task, very ambitious. I don't know how many ministers can do that today. And they wrote this one as one of the stream of hymns. And it just caught on. The melody, we're not quite sure. One singer, black woman, said, "Wouldn't it be ironic and an act of grace if that melody had been an old African melody that had been borrowed?" And it could well have been, could well have been. So the wedding of words and music in that song. We'll pick up right now, and then we'll move on afterwards. I'm going to just run through about 10, 15 minutes of it. Somebody want to hit those lights?
Amazing grace, how sweet south that say the wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. It was grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved.
That song has a very significant personal meaning to me. In that, my brother Jack, I recorded an album called Precious Memories. You dedicated the album to him. My brother Jack was killed in an accident in 1944. I lived in Dyess, Arkansas, D-Y-E-S-S. It was one of President Roosevelt's New Deal farms. The 14,000 acres was cut up into 20-acre tracts, each with a house and a barn and a mule. I think probably during that time, why that song dug so deep within my soul was that my mother and I and my sisters sang that song in the cotton fields after my brother died, as we worked. Here's what a man named David Allen Coe, just a friend, he signs himself ex-convict, says on the jacket of Johnny Cash Sings Precious Memories. It's been said he, Johnny Cash, has never been in prison, but I find myself looking at him as if he's done more time than I have. Each man has his own prisons. Mm-hmm. Perhaps his prisons weren't the same as mine, but I know his prisons have left their mark on him as surely as the 20 years I spent left more marks on me than the tattoos that cover my body.
We all do have our prisons, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We can get ourselves into a little prison of, drugs, alcohol, a relationship, or a habit, or a situation, that we weave ourselves into that can be like a prison. Bars that you can't break out of. Amazing grace, how sweet.
You ever think back to that first time you sang at the Huntsville prison back in 57?
Oh yeah, I sure do. That was my first prison concert at Huntsville.
I once was lost, but now I'm found.
For that 3 minutes that song is going on, everybody's free. And it just frees the spirit and frees the person.
Like the prisoners down in Huntsville, Alabama, we might be closer in many ways than we think. Nor the children, boys choir in Harlem, and yet those are our children. Just wanted to plug into one thing and then get you thinking about it. The prison scene brought back an experience I had when I was in Minnesota as a pastor in a church outside Minneapolis in Mound. And I got to know the superintendent of the Minneapolis workhouse, which was maybe 15 miles out of town. I think it was about near Wayzata in Minneapolis outside. And he was a Lutheran. And he said, we have a AA here, and a lot of people go to it, but we have an awful lot of people. In fact, the most articulate, probably most intelligent part of our population in jail. This was a workhouse, which was a first step for many people, although it was a catch-all jail. They had people from drunk drivers on to murderers. And he said, I'd like to try to apply some of the AA ideas to the check writing profession. And see if you could do something with that, Harold. And we talked about it a lot. So I pulled together the check writers. They were all invited. A lot of them came because they got out of their cells. And anything else, I was just curious. They have a lot of time. Well, they told me right off that they had AA, and some of them were already in AA. So they didn't want this to be a repeat of AA. And they said, well, what do you mean? Well, some of us have a hard time relating to the religious side of this. Couldn't we just start talking about our experiences and see where that takes us? These were con men, and I was conned. Because the very genius of AA was that you have come to the end of your rope. and you admit you are powerless over your addiction, alcohol, in this case check writing, whatever. And you turn your life over to a higher power as you conceive of this power. Right away, these guys con me into leaving out the first and most important step, right? So what did we do? Well, I gotta admit, in terms of confession, we had check writing 101. And I think we mostly just shot the breeze. And we mostly traded stories. Can you top this one? And people start getting into their capers. And I try to get them off and talk more seriously. And every time we try to get on to the spiritual basis, they'd say, that's AA, we can go to AA. Now we got some other things. Well, we didn't go very far. I remember one fellow who did get back to his religious roots. Interesting enough, he was a guy who had been raised as kind of a nominal Jew, became a Christian, then he left that all, and he got back to his Christian roots. And he said this group, kind of in spite of it almost, but it started something going. Then I met with some of them after they got out, because many of them were, you know, they're smart enough not to forge checks, but to just write checks with an account they had, but it was just open for $100, and they're busy writing $500,000 checks on it. And of course, the complicity of the merchants, the hotel people, the bar people that went around and cashed these checks, I think didn't do much. Because we forgot the only hope for all of us, whether we're in that kind of a physical prison, or whether we're in the prison of our own memories, our own addictions, our own grudges, our own fantasies, our own unfulfilled parts of our lives, sometimes realistic, sometimes totally unrealistic. We put on ourselves trips that God never would do to us. Whatever it is, it hangs us up. And the only hope for us then is to come to this kind of place where we realize we're powerless over this. Whatever it is, respectable workaholicism. Get a lot of money for that and a lot of credit for it. Would you believe you can become a churchaholic? You pastors here are cringing because they can't get enough help in the church. Well, it's usually, it's the 80-20 thing, you know, 20% of the people of every organization carry the load, or 80% kind of go along. But whatever my hang-up is, whatever yours is, to come to some surrender and serenity, those two words sound alike, don't they? Surrender and serenity. Well, it's not too late for any of us. I wish I could roll back the tape and go back to the Minneapolis workhouse. I would not be con this time. I would say, hey, we're here to do business with our relationship to God. We get that right, our rest of our life isn't going to automatically fall in place. There's a lot left to do, but at least we've got off on the right foot, and then we have a chance. And if I had one guy left, or zero, I'd been ahead of letting this thing go on. I watched these guys and I got a little bit cynical in some ways, not cynical, but a little more realistic, I think. I sensed that some of them were just halfway along, like John Newton when he was just giving the slaves a better break. The guy who was swaggering through the prison yard has a ways to go. You don't swagger like that when you've been crushed by the load of your sin and you really have let go and let God. You don't swagger quite like. You saw the looks in the faces of the other cons watching the swagger guy. Some of them smiled too easily about their sin and their past. I thought they were sort of on the way. I can't judge them all, but it does establish something that I think is very important, and I think we Lutherans take a pasting about our complacency and all the rest, and rightly so. But we've got some good things to offer, and one of the best is that we're not trapped into the notion that salvation is a once and for all easy, quick fix, a sort of a sort of a spiritual polio shot gets you fixed up for the rest of your life. I don't know that that's true, see. And I think even the people who have this very dramatic experience, and Luther apparently did, well, it was a struggle afterwards. He had a bigger struggle after he had that experience, St. Anne saved me, and the tree got split by the lightning and all, and Luther was spared. Well, that's just at the beginning. When we Lutherans are asked, maybe we are by some of our evangelical friends, we're evangelicals too, but they ask, were you saved? Are you saved? What do you say? You ever had people ask you that as a Lutheran? There's a joke about a guy in the plane that was asked by an earnest young man, are you saved? And the guy told him, he said, young man, he said, I'll have you know, I'm a Lutheran pastor. The kid says, don't let that stop you. What do you say if somebody asks you if you're saved? Yep. Well, and then you go on anyway? Okay, what if they follow up and say, when?
Through my baptism.
Yeah, do my best, is that what you said?
Through my baptism.
Through my baptism, good.
I've said, I was saved yesterday and today and tomorrow.
There you are. I think the good Lutheran and Christian, of course, is every day we're saved. Every day. You know, Luther said every day the old, he said man, but we mean person, of course. Old person is drowned with Christ in baptism and rises up a new person each day. You start out, this is a day which the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. We really believe our baptism, we are reborn every day. Every day we have a new start, a new chance. So, that would be the only thing I would kind of wonder about, the quick fix kind of thing. And to tell these guys, hey, you want to really struggle, then buy in. Buy in on the grace of Jesus Christ, and then you'll know what it is to be carried, but you'll also know what it is to sweat and to work and to change and go through the pain of that and to have every day as a new day before you. I like the part where you said the guy's free and yet in prison. I believe that. And a lot of people I know are free on the outside and imprisoned on the inside. And they walk around with all the money they need and they're free to go on in Europe tomorrow or anywhere else, and they're all bound up inside. Any other thoughts about this, what you saw?
It is, as you said, it's said several times on the tape too in the earlier part, the melody is such a grabber. I mean,
it really is.
Just brings tears to the eyes because that song's sung.
It's wonderful because sometimes we're afraid of the emotions, you know, we Lutherans like to speak to the head and not enough to the heart. Anybody else? What we're in there talking about, let's sing it. And share the hymnals. Anybody here play the piano? Got a volunteer? Anybody up there play the piano? Okay, who can sing on key? Got a couple of people. Who sings familiar with this and can start us off? 448. Let's sing all of them. Want to start us off, Bill?
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. Was blind, but now I see. Was raised.
going to read just a couple paragraphs from the book Addiction and Grace. It's by Gerald G. May, MD, who's a psychiatrist and teacher. Supervises a program for training spiritual directors at the Shalom Institute in Washington, D.C. There's a shalom and a shalom. This is shalom. Living into the mystery of grace requires encountering grace as a real gift. Grace is not earned. It is not accomplished or achieved. It is not extracted through manipulation or seduction. It is just given. Nothing in our conditioning prepares us for this radical reality. Some would say that early childhood experience with our parents is important in determining how we come to accept grace in later life. If we had loving, trustworthy parents rather than rejecting or unreliable ones, we would grow up more willing to accept God's grace as a gift. I do not think this is so. We all have trouble accepting the radical giftedness of God's grace, no matter what our childhood experience. God's grace is simply not part of our conditioning, nor can we make it so, though we are sure to try. All our attempts to control the flow of grace will be frustrated because, like God, grace will not become an object for attachment. Not something we possess and control, the genie in the bottle. Because grace is a pure gift, the most meaningful of our encounters with it will probably come at unintended times when we are caught off guard, when our manipulative systems are at rest or otherwise occupied. But still, we can pray for grace, actively seek it, and try to relax our hands to receive it. I'd like to have you think with me this evening about some of the experiences you've had. Because the past is prologue, it's also a way of getting a fix on the future, not knowing or being able to predict it, but having the confidence to face it. Because some of us are going to go back down this hill facing some pretty tough problems, whether they be health, vocational problems, discord within our family, worrying about the state of the world, you name it, it's out there. It's a tough world. We're relieved, probably, not to have radio and newspapers and television for a few days or weeks. But we got to go back and face it. We're like Jesus and his disciples on the top of the mountain, and they wanted to stay, you know, and Peter and all of them, eager, build booths, prayer places, stations, churches, chapels, let's stay here. He said, no, you've got to go down. And the first person they encountered, you remember, was an epileptic boy. So think about the past for a moment. Think about people who have been agents of grace for you, who have really been God's person, have been a small Christ to you, have been the right person at the right time, and maybe you didn't know it. And maybe, like me, you were irritated by that person because what the person said was perhaps inappropriate or something we didn't want to face about ourselves. And it wasn't until long afterwards that we realized what they had said and meant and how it came painfully to us, but for our own growth and grace. I think grace comes often painfully. It's painful, just as it is for an athlete to get in condition. You don't earn grace, so that analogy stops. But it's painful to receive something new sometimes. It's a radical kind of coming into our lives that doesn't leave us the same. And we don't like it. We don't like to be disturbed in our complacency or our sin. And those two could be synonymous. how a person who's hurt us, maybe severely, we can forgive them, but we can't forget some of the hurts as try as hard as we try. And yet, that person, could that person be actually an agent of grace? Huh. Those of you who are here, I am not going to do the number again. But I sort of had my little gut spilling thing yesterday. I got an insight afterwards about that. And one of the healing thoughts about my father, and I'll just simply say that my father was a very abusive man. And one of the healing thoughts that came maybe through the group, through something that was said and kind of collective consciousness of this group last night. Anyway, the thought I had was, yeah, in God's strange economy, God's, you know, the flip side of God, the kind of left-handed way God works and the craziness of God's actions compared to what we think any self-respecting, you know, predictable God ought to do. And I thought, wow, wait a minute. Could it be, and I almost sent chills up my spine, which it does really right now, could it be that my father, the mean old guy he was, at times very gentle, but not most of the time, could he have been an agent of grace for me? Could he have done things for me that I didn't like and didn't realize what was going on, but propelled me in a way that I wouldn't have gone? I don't know what kind of person I would have been without that. I like to think that I benefited more than I was hurt. That things that happened later would not have happened had not I had that father. Obviously, if I had not George Harold as my father, I would not be this person I am here, biologically, but also emotionally and spiritually. He was a good Lutheran, saint and sinner, simultaneously. And I perhaps am tempted to remember the sin more than the saintliness. And saintliness doesn't befit him too well. But in God's way of using pain as a means of grace, I got to stop and think about that one. And I thank you for the opportunity yesterday to do a little gut spilling and go away with the feeling that, wait a minute, can I say, I'm not conning myself, but can I say, George Harold was an agent of grace for me. I think I can. So now, I want you to think about that. I want you to think of someone, either a good influence, you know, the traditional saint in your life, the good image of God for you, of Jesus Christ for you, who was your mentor, your spiritual guide, who brought you along in the faith, maybe even physically brought you to church, the person that you most saw God in, that would be fine. But along with that, I want you to do another thing and think of somebody that you encountered along the way that came in a painful way into your life. And could that person have been there to teach you something? Painful divorce. When I come here, and so many couples that I've married, seems increasingly so, one or both have been married before, and the first question I ask, I don't try to play judge about it, but I say, what'd you learn from that experience? What'd you learn? If they say something flip, like, I learned not to marry that person, I don't think they learn much. Or they learned what a poor choice they made and blame the other person. Then I think we've got some more work to do. It seemed to me they learned much. Or they learn about themselves. See? So, two ways, and if you have time, talk about both, but at least one. Either a person who's positively a reflection of goodness and God for you and came in a very salutary and a very healthy, positive way and guided you. And then the flip side of that, somebody who was very painful in your life, and yet you might even see God working through that person. Okay? Is that a clear-cut kind of idea to talk about? And if you have time and you get through that, because we do want to come back and share a little, I only add the second one in case you still have some time. The second would be to talk about a time, maybe, and maybe it's related to the first, time when you felt saved, rescued, forgiven by amazing grace, okay? But get to the first one, because I think it's better to personify grace and talk about a person that was an agent of grace. So why don't we do this, take three or four of you, just group around, not more than four, two to four. Just turn your chairs around, and two to four of you, that would be fine. Got any more questions about what we're doing, holler.
Thank you.